Welcome back, everyone. It's that time of the week again for Podchat Live. Here we are on the 16th of April, 2024, recording episode 122, bringing a little bit of news, bringing some of the research we've seen in the last week. Here, as always, with my co-host, Craig. How has your week been, Craig? Are you well?
Yeah, no, I'm good. Now that my runs are getting a bit longer, I'm having to start listening, going back to listening to more and more audio books, and I'm just listening to one at the moment that, like, there's probably been two or three books that I've either read or listened to on my runs over the years that I'd love to see be made compulsory for everyone to read, and the one at the moment is called The Nocebo Effect, and I'm about 80% the way through it, almost finished it, and I'm absolute in awe of it. I'm obviously we both know about the Nocebo Effect, but this book just is brilliant. It is compulsory reading or listening, as far as I'm concerned. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I would recommend it to anyone if you don't know what this Nocebo Effect is, and if you don't know how important the words are you use in clinical practice. Then you need to read or listen to this book.
Lovely stuff. Kicking off with a book recommendation. That's a
Oh,
new.
I
We
know.
haven't lots. That's we haven't done book recommendations on the podcast, but I quite like that as a bit of a slump. I'm not sure we should be discouraging people from listening to Podchat Live on their runs, but if you're totally up to
Oh,
date,
well,
then
yeah.
absolutely audiobooks all the way.
Well, if
Marvelous.
you do, if you do, if you if you go for short runs, you can listen to Podchat Live. If you go for long runs, start listening to books.
Marvelous. On the topic of running, I know, we always talking about things we've seen in the news, and I've said it before. Often when we see podiatrists in the news, they've been doing nefarious or naughty things. So we like to bring good news as well. And certainly, I know we've mentioned in the past when podiatrists have achieved something rather impressive, usually in the sporting context. I know we've mentioned Jacqueline Simoneau before, who's going to the Olympic Games. Another podiatrist who is also an Olympian has been to the Tokyo Olympics, Matty Clark, last week became the men's national 3,000 meter steeplechase champion. I think I'm right in saying this is the third time he's become national champion. I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm wrong. He did it in front of his home crowd in Adelaide, as in that's where he lives because he works with our good friend Nitta. A time of 8:41:49, which, when I put it into the calculator, tells me that's an average pace of 2 minute 54 kilometers, which is just bananas. Do you know? I think Matty studied at La Trobe. Was that before
Yeah,
your time, after your time, Craig?
I did. Look, I know him, but I don't know him well. But yeah, that's pretty awesome. The 3,000 steeplechase used to be my event when I was at high school, but let's just say I was probably a minute per kilometre slower at that
Yeah.
time.
I don't think he's worried that you're coming for him. Great. That's some great running. And another shout out to another podiatrist who's also a runner, and that is London-based podiatric surgery trainee Con Rooney, who completed the Manchester Marathon at just last Sunday in 2:49, which once again is just a time that most of us could only dream of. So shout out to Con. That's also amazing. These are just people that I happen to follow on social media, so I can see their achievements. If you have achieved something great, or one of your colleagues or peers has, and we're not aware of it, do flag it to us, and we will of course give them a shout out, because it's lovely to shout out podiatrists doing amazing things rather than just being struck off for naughty things as well. Craig, before we press on with the articles, any shoe fact that you want to mention this morning?
Well, interestingly, I didn't have one, so I thought I'd be smart, and I went to ChatGPT and asked, "Please tell me an interesting shoe fact that I could use in a podcast." And it came back and told me that running shoes prevent injury, which, yeah,
Absolutely, absolutely
I guess Chat,
heartbroken that it clearly hasn't read the Cochrane review that I was part of. It's
yeah,
clearly more confident than we are.
Actually, I probably should have then gone and asked it, have you read the latest Cochrane review on this topic? But yeah, no. So
So,
Obviously, still an issue and still a topic worth discussing.
message to all the or word of warning to all the students out there: these large language models might seem useful tools to do your assignments and your coursework for your courses, but this is evidence that they don't always get it right.
Yeah.
And I assure you, as people marking your assignments, we do know when you've used it.
Yeah, actually, just on that, I recall, I think last week, I recall reading somewhere that a survey that something like 84% of university students have used AI for assignments. Like it's mind-boggling.
Speaking of someone that marks assignments, all I'm saying is, we know. You can tell. You can
Yeah.
tell.
Oh,
Anyway.
you can tell. I can tell if something's AI generated by reading it. Yeah.
Okay, so on with the articles. First up, this is a study that was published 4 days ago on the 12th of April, 2024, and it was published in the Journal of Medical Case Reports, which is an open access journal, from a group of researchers in Switzerland, which I don't think is a country we've mentioned when we've been talking about research before, so that's good. Title of the paper was Parietal Abdominal Pain with Lower Leg Discrepancy, a Case Report. I'm sure most of you know, but parietal means of or relating to the walls of or part of a cavity. So we're essentially talking here about abdominal pain in someone with a leg length discrepancy. So they refer to their report as the first publication which describes a case of parietal abdominal pain due to a leg length discrepancy. And it is a case history. Not that we have anything against case histories. I think they're incredibly useful at times, but it should be, the power of it should be viewed as such. It's a 50-year-old male who had chronic abdominal pain, which they state began in childhood. So chronic abdominal pain, but then on top of that, a sort of acute on chronic episodes as well, which would re often require analgesia. He couldn't sit for long periods of time. He'd recently lost his job. He was unable to play with his children and family members. Reading from the paper here, investigations revealed contracture and hypertrophy of the external oblique muscle and a limb length discrepancy of 38 millimeters. Now, the really interesting thing here is the clinical exam initially, where they looked at the ASIS to the medial malleolus, which is a fairly common clinical measure for leg length difference, estimated the difference at 40 millimeters, and the radiological investigations reported it as 38. Now, I don't find that particularly bad as far as measurement error goes, much better than I would expect. excuse me. Treatment involved a heel raise under the shorter leg of 20 millimeters, so about 50% of the difference. Weekly physiotherapy for 6 months, so that's seeing a physiotherapist once a week for 6 months. Two intramuscular Botox injections to the external oblique muscle, and also one lidocaine injection to the external oblique. And the outcome was ultimately a positive one in that the patient was able to return to work. They reported reduced analgesia use. I love these case histories in many ways, Craig. I don't want to get too carried away with them, but I think they're lovely narratives on we're so bogged down in the research and the power of research and statistical significance. But what we've got here is a 50-year-old man, which is a man around our age, who lost his job and couldn't play with his children, who now has got back his quality of life. So I want to try and balance that very real world outcome, and that's a positive thing, with the science here. So give me your thoughts on this.
Oh yeah, no, I enjoyed reading this because yeah, here's someone with abdominal pain. Who would have thought to think check the leg length difference? like something as simple as that. If his pain was say postural or spinal, yeah, of course you would have expected that leg length would have been checked at some stage, but not for abdominal pain. I would doubt any physician. Well, maybe not. Would even look at him standing and evaluating his abdominal pain, and to see a leg length difference. Now it was quite a substantial leg length difference. As you said, 38 millimeters, 1.5 inches for those who still. So it was quite substantial. Again, my rule of thumb in treating a leg length difference is treat half it. Well, they did half it. So, yeah, no, look, it was a nice little review. And obviously, makes you wonder how many other abdominal pains are not have not been checked for leg length differences.
How much credit, or no, let me rephrase this. How much blame or causation do we attribute to the leg length difference, and how there thus how much credit should we potentially give to the open quotations balance close quotations with the heel raise, given that there was fairly significant other treatments kind of concurrently as well? Do you, I guess what I'm asking here is, with physio and injection might have got him there, right?
Look, I mean, I'm no expert on that part of the body, but there was the muscular issues which might have been triggered by the leg length difference. So the injections and the physiotherapy of those muscular issues may have resolved his symptoms. But then again, you could argue that, well, if they didn't deal with the leg length difference, maybe those problems would come back. Again, lots of speculation. But yeah, well, it would have been nice to perhaps just done the heel raise and see what happens.
Or you know, what you may do in, you know, true clinical practice is you might have a sort of battery of possible modalities you're considering, and you may introduce them sequentially, rather than all at the same time. But a lovely outcome. It is just a case series. So bear that in mind when you're reading it. But we also need to remind ourselves that people we see in clinic are individuals who are just looking for improved quality of life and things. So yeah. An interesting one to kick off, I think. Let's move on to the second paper, which was published yesterday. So that was the 15th of April, 2024. It was published in Foot and Ankle International, and a group of researchers who were orthopedic surgeons, which I think will become quite clear soon anyway, from here in the UK, based out of Stanmore and UCL in London. The title of this paper is Foot Morphotypes in Cavovarus Feet, a Novel Assessment of Deformity. Now, I will admit I wasn't entirely sure what morphotype meant. It isn't a term that I particularly come across or particularly use, so I stuck it into Google and asked Google what morphotype meant, and it told me morphotype is any of a group of different types of individuals of the same species in a population. I guess my first thought is I'm not sure that's the most appropriate word, but I could be wrong there. But it's not a word I've used, I'm particularly familiar with, and I'm not entirely certain it's the best word. But the wordsmiths out there can correct me if I'm wrong. This was a retrospective case series, so it's level four evidence, so to be viewed through that lens. And their aim was a very surgical one, unsurprisingly. It was to analyse the pattern of residual forefoot deformities once the hindfoot is corrected. So after doing hindfoot correction surgery, I'm using orthopedic surgery terminology here, then what residual forefoot deformities were left, and that could potentially guide surgical decisions at the forefoot. So they took 16 patients who had between them 20 Cavovarus feet, and these were patients with Charcot-Marie tooth. So we're visualizing quite a I guess a neurological cavus here. Now, they used software to simulate surgery. So they didn't actually perform surgery on any of these people. They sort of, you know, input their data into this software, and essentially within the software, put the talonavicular joint into a more normal position, normal in quotation marks there. And then they saw what deformities were remaining at the forefoot. And they found four different types, which I'll just read verbatim as they reported them. Type zero, when you essentially correct the rear foot, is a balanced forefoot, and that happened in just two cases, so 10%. Type one was with a corrected rear foot, you get a plantar flexed first metatarsal, and that happened in 12 cases, 60%. Type two was plantar flexed first and second metatarsals in four cases, 20%. And type three, metatarsals were adducted, adducted in two cases, 10%. And they concluded that this may help surgeons recognize and anticipate residual forefoot deformities after hindfoot correction. I don't know your thoughts, Craig. I'll ask them in a minute, but this what immediately came to mind here was the terminology that was being used, the categorization that was being used, the general kind of foot typing approach, and how it felt very, I guess, from a surgical perspective, very corrective, radiologically speaking, but not much else. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, look, well, obviously, as soon as I read it, my mind immediately went to Root's concept of subtalar joint neutral, load the lateral column, talking about forefoot valgus, plantar flex, first rate. So we could spend an hour or two just talking on that and the say the comparison between his concepts and what they found in these particular studies. But then what it raised for me is if we look back what Mert Root did, he came up with these different morphotypes himself, based on his classification. What these people did that was different, rather than just come up with them, they actually used a statistical analysis to look at groupings. And that's been done more and more often, especially in the last few years. You see, rather than trying to classify someone and then go off and research it, you just get all the data, run the software, and it will then group them together. And that's what they've done. Now, I don't know which is the better approach or not, but again, it's this, say, obsession with classifying. Again, as you said, it's all structural, not necessarily functional. But no, but again, it was just that I just found it just interesting. Not sure it's going to change my clinical practice.
No, same. No, absolutely the same. You just can't help but shake that kind of more contemporary viewpoint that we now have, or thought process we now have, which is that this just is talking about foot shape and foot structure, not function, not pain, not pathology. But interesting nonetheless. Maybe one for the podiatric surgeons to get their teeth stuck into. Final paper, and I think possibly of the three we've talked about this evening for me, this morning for you, possibly my favorite. This is published ahead of print, so it's going to be in the May 2024 edition, so next month's edition of Physical Therapy in Sport. And it's from a group of researchers, primarily from Australia, but there's a couple of collaborators, one from Spain, and one from the Netherlands as well. And it is called Are We Asking the Right Questions to People with Achilles Tendinopathy? The Best Questions to Distinguish Mild versus Severe Disability to Improve Your Clinical Management. So this title grabbed me because it immediately is something that you just get the sense will be very applicable to clinical practice. They took 70 participants who had Achilles tendinopathy, and they looked at them through essentially through three outcome tools, which are well known and well validated. There's Tendins A, which is tendinopathy severity assessment for the Achilles. There's the FAOS, the foot and ankle outcome score, and there's the VISA-A, probably the most well known for the Achilles, which is the Victorian Institute of Sports Assessment Achilles. They looked at these outcome tools and essentially their capacity to differentiate patients with mild and severe tendon-related disability. And their ultimate aim was to try and then, again, as they've already said, tease out and provide clinicians with the best questions to ask when consulting patients with Achilles tendinopathy. So they did lots of rather clever statistics, which I won't bore people with and probably will just highlight my not complete understanding of them. But ultimately, they ended up generating the top 10 best performing items, which can discriminate between the disability tertiles. And lots of them were the score, the NPRS, the numerical pain rating score, with certain functional tests. But what really came out were the things that we should probably be asking. Now, I think most of us are asking these things already, but I think it's really nice just to make sure that in our history taking for tendinopathic Achilles, we're including these. Ultimately, in conclusion, pain with loading, time for pain to settle following activity, as well as time for pain to settle following prolonged sitting and also sleeping, are the must-ask questions with regard to identifying the severity of Achilles tendinopathy. So essentially, if you're not doing it already, you need to be finding out the degree of reduction in physical activity from pre-injury levels. You need to be asking questions like the difficulty in completing things like running in the past week. And you need to be asking in minutes the time taken for pain, stiffness symptoms to subside following aggravating activities, following waking up, and following prolonged sitting. I suspect, Craig, that most people who are seeing Achilles tendinopathies and other tendinopathies are probably asking those questions, but what a lovely evidence-informed reminder of how a history taking, not that's not what the total of a history taking should look like, but the must-ask questions within a broader history taking.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's a nice contrast with those studies that look at the effects of different treatments. This is a study looking at our assessment and looking at evidence for our assessments and whether then those sort of the evidence is about whether these assessments are predictive of outcomes or whether our assessments are predictive of different types. I was really happy about this study because of item number 8. I know in my own personal history with Achilles tendinopathy, what it was like when I got out of bed in the morning and how long it took to settle was a real big issue. And it's kind of interesting. That's influenced the question you ask clinically. What's it like when you get out of bed in the morning? How long does it take to settle? Like, so it's nice to see there's some, it made the list. But yeah, it's time to settle after aggravation, time to settle after that sort of post sort of static sort of symptom. So no, like, yeah, really nice study. Very well done. I mean, all the stats look good to me. I can't see any issues there. So it'd be nice to have more evidence for other things we allegedly do in our assessments that that don't have any evidence backing them.
Yeah, really interesting to hear you say there that your history taking, from a patient with a certain problem has been hugely influenced by you suffering with that problem. Because I've had exactly the same. I've been nursing a posterior ankle impingement for about 6, 7 months now. And anytime I see a posterior ankle impingement in clinic, I just feel like my history taking is just really, really solid because I know exactly what the provocative factors are for it. I know when it feel, what makes it feel better and what makes it feel worse and things. So it's a real level of empathy that I think in many ways you almost wish you could, I mean, touch wood, this doesn't happen to any of us, but you almost wish you could have every single pathology you're going to see in clinic just once. And I suspect it would make you a much better clinician.
But even if you were to mention to the patient while you're doing the history, oh yeah, I had a bit of this myself. Yeah, well, they suddenly they got more faith in you.
Yeah. Right. Let's wrap things up. As always, please do give us a follow on social media, Podchat Live on all the usual places and vehicles. Please do email us with any comments, any questions, anything you want to flag or ask us or make us aware of. Email is getinvolved@podchatlive.com. And finally, please do rate us, review us, etc. on the main podcast vehicles as well. We are still at 28 ratings on Apple, 66 ratings on Spotify. They have not moved for a couple of weeks. You guys and girls are just being horrible at spreading the love and spreading the word. So I would once again on my knees beg you to do so. I'm told the more ratings you get, the better your reach, and generally the better the reach. Hopefully, the more people can join the conversation, and we all, including myself and Craig, learn more in the process. So, Craig, I am off to the US tomorrow, actually. But I'll be pleased to tell you, I am back next Tuesday, just in time for us to record. So we do not need to miss next week's episode. I will. That's how important I consider this podcast. I make sure I work my holidays in between when we record it. So I look forward to catching up with you next week.
No worries. Okay, great. Thanks. See ya.